Headlines this hour, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is facing calls for resignation as he grapples with yet another scandal over a party during COVID lockdown. Yemen's army says it has inflicted heavy human and material losses on mercenary forces hired by the United Arab Emirates during an operation in Shabwa province. Also coming up in this newscast, Iran seeking the return of thousands of ancient tablets that the United States has been holding for almost a century. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. The British Prime Minister is facing fresh ire over the breach of COVID rules. The leader of the opposition Labour Party demands Boris Johnson quit over a Downing Street party during a 2020 national lockdown.
Mr. Speaker, so we've got the Prime Minister attending Downing Street parties, a clear breach of the rules. We've got the Prime Minister putting forward a series of ridiculous denials, which he knows are untrue. Yeah. A clear breach of the ministerial code. That code says ministers who knowingly mislead Parliament will be expected to offer their resignation. The party's over, Prime Minister. The only question is, will the British public kick him out, will his party kick him out, or will he do the decent thing and resign?
Johnson, in response, has apologised after admitting that he also attended the party. The Premier, however, deflected the opposition's demand for his resignation. He added that he would not preempt the findings of an independent inquiry into parties at his office during lockdowns. Some in Johnson's Conservative Party have also said that he should quit if found to have broken laws the government brought in to prevent the spread of the virus. So far, several leaked videos and emails revealed about the parties held at Downing Street Garden, but Johnson says that he cannot comment until a senior government official concludes an internal investigation. A correspondent in London, Syed Pour Reza, says Britons are not happy with Prime Minister Boris Johnson's conduct or apology over Downing Street party scandals.
It was indeed, as you say, a grueling grilling that happened in PMQs, the Prime Minister's questions today at the British Parliament. We heard Keir Starmer, the Labour leader's comments earlier, but perhaps maybe other scathing attacks came from the SNP, the Scottish National Party Member of Parliament, Ian Blackford, who accused the Prime Minister of betraying the public trust and treating the public with contempt, and again called for his resignation, attack after attack from the Labour Party, and all along, very quiet Conservative Party representatives in Parliament today. Probably an admission that the Prime Minister, what he did and the rest of the people around him was very wrong. And that raises a lot of questions about the future of this Prime Minister in power. We heard, of course, the Prime Minister apologize and say that he wished things had happened in a different manner. But a lot of people online, as we have all been following, are not accepting that apology. They're saying it's a non-apology apology, in which he basically seems to have tried to blame it on the junior staff or other people and hide behind them, not really a heartfelt apology from the Prime Minister himself.
Russia says pan-European security is at a critical point and that the West needs to respond to Moscow's concerns about NATO activities near its borders. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov made the remarks following talks with NATO aimed at easing tensions over Ukraine. The Kremlin says it has laid out demands for security guarantees, but insists that it is not issuing any ultimatums. Moscow has repeatedly called on the Western military alliance to halt its eastward expansion. Russia also wants NATO to promise that it won't accept Ukraine as a member. The Russia-NATO Council has just held its first meeting in 2 years. Moscow also held talks with Washington and Geneva over the weekend to address growing tensions between Russia and the West. The U.S. and its allies accused Russia of preparing an invasion against Ukraine, but Moscow rejects that claim. Let's cross on over now to Brussels and listen to the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, speaking.
Reciprocal limits on missiles and many other issues to prevent a new armed conflict. At the same time, we are clear-eyed So we also convey a message to Russia that if they use military force, there will be severe consequences, economic sanctions, political sanctions. We provide support, practical support to Ukraine to strengthen their ability to defend themselves. Allies do that in different ways. Then I think it's important in a way to also understand that Ukraine is a partner. We provide them support, political, practical support in many different ways, but Ukraine is not a NATO member. So the security guarantees, what we call Article 5, one for all for one, that applies for NATO members. And that's also the reason why we so clearly have stated that we will do what it takes to defend all NATO allies. An attack on one ally will trigger a response from the whole alliance. And that is clearly conveyed. I think it's very dangerous to start to speculate too much about that. There is a real risk, and we relate to that possibility, partly by engaging in dialogue, in good faith, but also partly being clear-eyed about the risk for a breakdown of these talks.
I know there are many questions. We'll end with Associated Press.
Lauren Cook from Associated Press. Secretary General, President Putin had an agreement, a draft agreement, that he wanted to discuss with NATO. Did the Russian delegation put that agreement on the table today? And you've rejected the core principles of that. So is it off the table completely now? Thank you.
So Russia has put that proposal, that treaty on the table. Has sent it to the United States and to NATO, and of course they also went through those proposals, presented those proposals in the meeting today, and argued in favor of these proposals. NATO allies made it clear that, of course, we are open for dialogue. We can discuss many issues, but we cannot discuss some core principles, like, for instance, the freedom to choose your own path, including what kind of security arrangements each and every country in Europe wants to be part of, and our right to defend all allies, including Eastern allies. But, again, it's possible to agree on verifiable reciprocal arms control, something that is balanced on conventional nuclear missiles and other areas, and we stated that very clearly too.
Thank you very much. This concludes this press conference.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, speaking there. Well, when we came in, he talked about how if they, in reference to Russia, uses nuclear force, there will be a response. So you could see how that sets the tone for this press conference and how it has set the tone of the aggressive nature that is, and the crisis mode that these talks are in. We will strengthen Ukraine, he said. Ukraine is a partner. However, Ukraine is not a NATO member, he said, but we will support them. He said there are security guarantees that Russia wants. We can't fulfill that at this point. Stoltenberg rejected the core principles of a Russian proposal, or treaty as he referred to it, at this point. That's what he was asked. He said those have been forwarded to the U.S. NATO allies are for dialogue. We won't negotiate on NATO's core principles, however, he said. And finally, need reciprocal arms control. And he said we need something that is balanced in reference to Russia and that issue. The press conference there by Jens Stoltenberg. And a very important 3 or 4 days now at this point of talks that have happened between the United States and Russia, with NATO obviously putting its 2 cents in there. Well, Russia has long complained that the U.S. and its Western allies in NATO are deliberately creating and escalating tensions over Ukraine. Now our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, explains why they are doing so.
One of the main issues here is, you know, it's about money. It's about that the EU and NATO need an enemy. And, of course, it's a very easy target that they create Russia into this enemy. And they make the point that really to justify NATO and to justify the new EU army and to justify billions of euro being spent by the EU on creating an EU army, when many of those countries are also members of NATO and they're spending billions more on NATO, they need an enemy, and of course, to justify the existence of the NATO alliance, they need Russia. So really, you have to wonder about what's happening more deeper on the background of all of this. But we see a situation whereby the red line for Putin is that Ukraine cannot join NATO, because we've already seen on the Black Sea and in countries close to Russia's borders that are members of NATO, we've seen military drills, war games, building closer and closer to Russia's borders over the years. And it's provocation. And the claim is, it sounds like it's a conspiracy theory, but really it isn't. The claim is that it's all to fuel more spending on arms, more development growth of NATO, the EU army, and of course, Russia is an easy target in this regard.
The Yemeni army provides details of its latest military operation against some Emirati-backed mercenaries in southern Yemen. It says the armed forces and their allied popular committees have inflicted heavy human and material losses on the UAE-backed elements. The army spokesman Yahya Sari says the operation involving missile strikes took place in Shabwa province over the past few days. He says that as a result, 515 UAE-backed mercenaries were killed and more than 800 others injured. According to Sari, over 100 military vehicles were destroyed. Over the past 7 years, loyalists of the former Yemeni regime have been fighting in some parts of the country against the new government and its allied Ansarullah movement. Ex-regime loyalists are backed by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, both part of a coalition which launched the war in Yemen in March 2015. Our Sana correspondent, Abdulatif Al-Washali, gave us more on the operation. He says the Yemeni army is very likely to launch further operations against UAE-backed mercenaries to expel them from Shabwa and other provinces.
Saudi Arabia has been escalating its operations in Mali for the past 2 years, but now we see the UAE escalating the situation in Shabwa province by bringing thousands of mercenaries to that area to fight against the Yemeni army and the popular committees. The Yemeni army managed to take down hundreds of them and injure hundreds of others. Actually, the families of these areas in Harib and Shabwa and all the areas have been fighting beside the Yemeni army against those mercenaries. They are not welcomed in that place. They know that the UAE-backed forces will break into their houses, and this is actually has happened during the few past days. They broke into houses, they kidnapped tens of citizens from their homes. This is why the families of these areas are fighting beside the Yemeni army. They want to expel these foreign forces from their land. They are not welcomed. They want to stay without having any foreign powers in their area in Shabwa. The Yemeni army will absolutely take the advantage of this and fight these forces to expel them from all the territories, not only from Shabwa, but also from the Marib and other provinces. The Yemeni army will absolutely, I believe, launch further operations against UAE.
90 years ago, the University of Chicago in the U.S. borrowed tens of thousands of archaeological fragments discovered in Iran's ancient city of Persepolis for research. However, after nearly a century, despite many official requests and a court ruling, Washington is still refusing to return them, using a variety of pretexts. But Tehran is now resolved to get back what is its rightful possession.
These artifacts are just a few amongst the thousands of clay tablets discovered in an excavation in Iran's old city of Persepolis more than 9 decades ago. Back then, American archaeologists borrowed the Persepolis collection for a period of 3 years for translation, research, and cataloging. Flash forward 90 years, and many of these ancient fragments are still at the Oriental Institute in the University of Chicago. At some points over the past decades, Washington even attempted to seize this collection of antiquities using its anti-Iran allegations. But in 2018, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in favor of Iran's ownership of these assets. Susan Cherokchi, a legal expert with Iran's Ministry of Cultural Heritage, says it is time for these artifacts to return home.
This is the year 2022. 4 years have passed since the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in favor of lifting the ban on these tablets. But the Persepolis tablets, the borrowed properties of the Iranian government and nation, have not returned home, except for a few of them. Still, the majority of these valuable artifacts are in the possession of the Oriental Institute, and logically, after 9 decades, they need to be sent back to Iran.
She has even disclosed some parts of the correspondence taking place between Iranian and American officials in 1934, based on which the American side agrees to return the inscribed tablets at its own expense. Another article requires the Chicago University's Oriental Institute to send copies of the works, reviews, and collections to Iran's then Ministry of Instruction. Promises never fulfilled. American experts themselves stress the significance of these antiquities for studying ancient Persian history.
These tablets are one of the most important sources for us about the Achaemenid dynasty at their peak.
Abdul-Majid Arfai, a distinguished Iranian expert of ancient languages, says these tablets reveal some remarkable information about the ruling period of Darius the Great.
One of the clay tablets reveal an order by Darius the Great to an assistant to give 100 of Darius's own sheep to a woman. Decoding this tablet reveals that all of the clay manuscripts belong to the era of Darius.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht-Ravanchi, says Americans are using different excuses to postpone the return of what is part of Iran's culture and history. But Iran's request is clear, that what has been loaned must return completely, orderly, and safely. At the end of the day, these antiquities are nothing but the belongings of the Iranian nation and representatives of their long history.
Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development, Rostam Qasemi, says the end of war in Syria is the beginning of a new era of economic relations between the two countries. Qasemi is heading an economic and political delegation on a 3-day visit to Syria. He will meet with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other top officials. The Iranian minister has said that his talks with the Syrian officials will cover various fields, including industry and construction. Upon his arrival in Damascus, Qasemi was welcomed by the Syrian Economy and Trade Minister. Mohammad Samer al-Khalil said that his country seeks extensive cooperation with Tehran. Iran has been a major contributor to Syria's reconstruction efforts in recent years, as the country struggles to emerge from the ruins of the war that devastated its economic infrastructure. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Guantanamo stands as a reminder of the enduring barbarism and savagery unleashed upon innocent Muslims by the Islamophobia generated in the West after 9/11. says Peter O'Born, journalist, in an article published under the heading Guantanamo, an enduring symbol of the savagery unleashed upon innocent Muslims. Stay tuned for more. Years ago, a Pakistani taxi driver called Ahmad Rabbani was kidnapped by Pakistani state authorities from his home in Karachi and taken to the country's capital, Islamabad. From there, he was transferred to Kabul, the notorious dark prison near Kabul in Afghanistan, where he was held in CIA custody. The Senate Select Committee report on torture, published 10 years ago, has documented what Rabbani and many others experienced. Kobalt's blackout windows left prisoners isolated in total darkness and often without heat in Afghanistan's freezing winters. They were shackled to bars with their hands forced above their heads, meaning they could never rest. Loud music was played constantly, denying sleep. Some detainees were subjected to cigarette burns. Others were stripped naked, hosed down with water, and placed in cold cells. Rabbani, 52, said that for days on end, he was hung by the hand to an iron shackle where my toes hardly touched the ground. This torture, known as estrapado, was favored by the Spanish Inquisition. After 540 days in Cobalt, Rabbani was rendered to Guantanamo Bay, the offshore military prison where U.S. law does not apply, meaning that the U.S. regime was able to hold detainees indefinitely without charge as enemy combatants. Rabbani is innocent. As the Senate report recorded in 2012, he had been mistaken for an al-Qaeda operative called Hassan Ghul. The United States has known this for a decade, probably much longer. He is still in Guantanamo today. Many have suffered in the same way. In total, almost 800 men have been imprisoned during its 20-year history. Rabbani, a Rohingya Pakistani, weighed around 73 kilograms at the time of his arrest. Emaciated from a hunger strike, today he weighs just 30 kilograms, meaning he likes to joke that 57% of him escaped from Guantanamo. He suffers mentally and finds it hard to remember things. His family have been tortured too, but in a different way. In Islamabad last autumn, reporters met his 18-year-old son, Jawad. Jawad has never met his father, who was seized a few months before he was born. He told reporters how, as a child, his mother explained his father's absence by saying that Rabbani was away working in Saudi Arabia. He first spoke to him when he was 6 years old in a 15-minute telephone call arranged by the Red Cross. His father told him he was in jail. Jawad said, "I asked him, why are you in jail? The jail is supposed to be bad for bad people." He laughed and didn't reply. Jawad said, "This knowledge started to affect me a lot when he became a teenager." Jawad said, "I went to the dark web when I was 13 or 14 years old. So I looked for the videos, those people who tortured and how they torture and all the things you get on the dark web. I was in those groups where they used to share those videos where they tortured people and all those things. So I do have an idea of how they tortured him and all the things. Waterboarding, to kick him, or playing music that will torture my dad. How they will make miserable his brain and all the things. I knew it. There was a time that I used to believe my father had committed a crime. That's why he has been tortured, because you don't torture a person for no reason. I used to cry, you know, at night in my room. Just imagine your life without your father for 18 years. What would you be? If he didn't touch you or care for you or provide you his love, his money, everything, where would you be? Jawad added. Jawad became introverted and tormented. He could never make friends because he felt unable to talk about his family circumstances. Jawad says the turning point came when he met Clive Stafford Smith, the British lawyer who has represented more than 80 of the Guantanamo detainees. Jawad said, "I learned after that meeting that my father is innocent. The second thing is that I shouldn't be ashamed of my father because he's in jail." It's a repellent story. The United States regime completely abandoned the rule of law and any pretense of due process with its practice of arbitrary detention and torture or enhanced interrogation. Britain complied meekly with the U.S. imprisoning and torturing British citizens without charge. British intelligence was involved in interrogations. Habeas corpus, that famed ancient liberty, which ensures that no one can be imprisoned unlawfully, has been completely disregarded in the war on terror. In the jingoistic post-9/11 atmosphere, Muslims were deemed by many in the West to be undeserving of basic human rights. It is inconceivable that the British government would have stood by as a white Christian Briton was tortured and imprisoned in Cuba. In the case of British Muslims, however, they considered it unproblematic. Every prisoner has been Muslim. The first 20 detainees arrived there 20 years ago, on January 11, 2002. Guantanamo constructs terrorism as a Muslim crime, requiring an alternative legal structure to cope with what was seen as the exceptional horror of Muslim crimes. The prison remains open today. Innocent men are sitting in their cells there at this very moment. The prison stands as a reminder of the enduring barbarism and savagery unleashed upon innocent Muslims by the Islamophobia generated in the West after 9/11.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
Jannah wasiyul mustafa haqqan imam an-nas wal jinnah.
You're listening to the program Gates of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahj al-Balagha. We are presently discussing the 16th sermon, where Imam Ali alayhi salam comes and offers his strategy in leadership and his methodology of leadership. And there he of course mentions some things in a very straightforward way, because as a leader he had to make it clear about the goals and about the strategy that he has to follow, and this was something very important. And as we mentioned, that Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he was offering a legislation, a method of social governance, a political theory or a political method of governance, that political system was definitely a true system. Why was it true? Because he was aware of the society. He had true knowledge of the society. He had knowledge and awareness of the essence of the society, of the laws, the natural laws, the divine, overruling decrees that govern the society, and the natural, laws that exist within a society. And because of this awareness, he had that ability and that suitability to be able to offer a powerful political system.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
And we said previously, of course, that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he talks about one of those laws, and that law is that if a person were to contemplate, if a society were to contemplate on the past regarding the progress and the deterioration of the societies and the reasons behind that, then definitely that society, those people will be protected from making wrong decisions in the community. And then Imam Ali alayhi salam comes and gives one example of an analysis, offers an example of an analysis in recent history which was applicable to them at that time. He says a very surprising and perturbing thing. He says, أَلَا إِنَّ بَنِيَّتَكُمْ قَدْ عَادَتْ كَهَيْئَتِهَا يَوْمَ بَعَثَ اللَّهُ نَبِيَّكُمْ. He says, O people, your situation today is the same as your situation when the messenger of God came to you. You are facing the same problem. Your problem has returned. That same problem that your fathers had, that same malady that your fathers had, has come back to you today. O sick people, O humanity that is ill and sick, you have the same sickness once again, just like the one you had when the Prophet came to you. That means the sickness has returned, the illness has come back, the virus has come back. And Ali alayhi salam was a doctor. He knew that this sickness has returned. And that is what he was telling the people. And he knew that he could cure it. And he wanted to cure it. But now, what was this sickness? Again, see, Imam Ali alayhi salam, because of his awareness of the social laws, he knows that this sickness has come back. And the reason behind this sickness is people have tranquilized themselves. And they do not want to contemplate and analyze the recent history and see the application of those difficulties and problems and the reasons why those problems came in their life today. So he knew that the sickness has come back, and this is something that we're going to analyze shortly.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, some would say, what is this sickness? Unfortunately, some falsely claim that this thing that Imam Ali alayhi salam says, this baliya, this difficulty, this problem that has come back, is just, you know, differences in opinion, conflict and schism that exists between people. That's what they say. They say that difficulty and that problem that you're facing, that sickness that the people are facing today, and it is the same sickness that the Muslims had at the time of the Prophet, was the illness, was the sickness, was the problem of conflict and difference and dissimilarity and fighting. That is the problem that they are saying. But is this actually what Imam Ali was to say? Was the sickness of the people just a few differences or some conflict that existed between them? Was this the problem at that time? If we ask the question carefully, we'll see no, this was not the problem. Because the true Muslims were all united. They were not disunited, or they didn't have any difference. There was no conflict between them. They all came together. Thousands and thousands of them came to Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they all united under his leadership. Well, some would say that Sa'd bin Abi Waqas, Talha and Zubair, they kind of separated themselves. We would say that this was not a difference. This was not a difference or a very considerable, serious difference, because it was just a very, very trivial issue which led them to be separate. We can't say that this was a conflict within the nation. The whole nation was in conflict and indifference. We cannot say that. And therefore, those people who claim that actually the problem that Imam Ali alayhi salam is referring to here is conflict, differences, dissimilarities and disunity, this doesn't seem to be a correct view. But inshallah, we will discuss about what is actually what Imam Ali alayhi salam meant here when he said that your difficulty and your problem and your sickness has returned, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من نداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد مجيد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. U.S. President Joe Biden strikes different tone in tacit admission that ignoring the most powerful force in the Republican Party is risky. We now present you an article written by Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled Strategy Shift: Biden Confronts Trump Head-On After Year of Silent Treatment. First months of his presidency, Joe Biden called on Americans to set aside their deep divisions inflamed by a predecessor he intentionally ignored. He emphasized national unity and appealed to Americans to come together to end this uncivil war. Nearly a year later, as a divided nation reflects on the first anniversary of the 6th of January assault on the U.S. Capitol, the uncivil war he sought to extinguish rages on, stronger than ever. In a searing speech on Thursday, 6th of January 2022, Joe Biden struck a different tone. He said he was crystal clear about the dangers facing the nation and accused former U.S. President Donald Trump and his political allies of holding a dagger to the throat of America at American democracy. In the course of the 21-minute speech delivered from the U.S. Capitol, Biden offered himself as a so-called defender of democracy in the battle for the soul of America. He promised, "I will stand in this breach," claiming, "I will defend this nation." That moment of visceral speechmaking marked a shift in strategy from how Biden had chosen to engage Donald Trump, whose name he never uttered, but instead taunted as a defeated former president. The decision to break his silence about former U.S. President Donald Trump comes at a challenging moment in Biden's presidency, with his Build Back Better agenda stalled, the COVID-19 pandemic resurgent, and economic malaise widespread. It also reflects the reality that, far from being shunned, Donald Trump remains the most powerful force in the Republican Party, and definitely a potential rival to Joe Biden in 2024. Confronting Donald Trump was a calculated risk. Trump seized the opportunity to hurl all manner of insults and accusations at his successor, whose remarks, he said, were very hurtful to many people. But Joe Biden's speech was an acknowledgement that there were dangers in continuing to ignore Donald Trump and what Biden called his web of lies. Recent polling suggests the vast majority of Republicans believe Donald Trump's unsubstantiated claims about the election fraud, while a growing percentage of Americans are willing to tolerate political violence in some instances. Republican-controlled states are pursuing a raft of new voting restrictions, motivated in part by the doubts they sowed about the 2020 presidential election results. At the same time, Republicans are passing laws that inject partisanship into the administration of elections and vote counting, while stripping power from the driving power from election officials who resisted pressure to throw out votes or overturn their elections in their state. Julian Zelizer, a historian at Princeton University, said, "It was essential to be specific about the problem and the source of the crisis. Otherwise, the vague rhetoric without agency that we hear about polarization misses the way in which Donald Trump and the GOP are the source of so much instability." But he warned that a speech can only do so much. Julian Zelizer added, "Without holding people accountable for 6th of January and the campaign against the 2020 election, and without real legislation to protect voting rights and the electoral process, the dagger at the throat of democracy won't go away." In his remarks, U.S. President Joe Biden argued that protecting voting rights was paramount to safeguarding American democracy. He sought to connect the dots between Donald Trump's promotion that the 2020 election was tainted by fraud and Republicans' coordinated effort to subvert and undermine the electoral process in states where they control the levers of power. He said, "Right now, in state after state, new laws are being written, not to protect the vote, but to deny it. Not only to suppress the vote, but to subvert it. Not to strengthen or protect our democracy, but because the former president lost." Joe Biden will follow up on the theme in coming days when he delivers another consequential speech on voting rights. In Atlanta, Georgia, Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris will call for the passage of two voting rights bills that face daunting odds in the U.S. Senate: the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. The issue of voting rights has taken center stage after hopes of passing Joe Biden's sweeping domestic policy agenda were dashed by the opposition of Senator Joe Manchin, the conservative Democrat from West Virginia. So far, Republican opposition has blocked passage of the legislation in the evenly divided chamber, where Democrats lack the 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, again holds the key on voting rights legislation, which he broadly supports. But his opposition to eliminating the filibuster has forced Democrats to pursue other avenues, such as creating an exception in the rules for certain legislation. The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said he would schedule a vote on easing the filibuster rules not later than 17th of January, which is Martin Luther King Day. President Biden has faced immense pressure from civil rights leaders and voting rights advocates frustrated with his handling of the issue, seen as critical to the president's legacy. Indeed, according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, a coalition of Georgia-based voting rights groups warned President Biden and Vice President Harris not to bother coming to the state unless they delivered a concrete plan to move forward. The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters recently that President Biden planned to stress the urgent need to pass legislation to protect the constitutional right to vote and the integrity of our elections. Spencer Overton, an election law expert and the president of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, hopes that Biden will use his bully pulpit to explain why passing federal voting rights legislation is so essential to combating the lies and conspiracies undermining faith in the nation's system of government. Spencer Overton said, "Those lies have real consequences. Sometimes they're graphic, as we saw a year ago on 6th of January, but sometimes they silently erode democracy by preventing average citizens from participating in our democracy and exercising their freedom to vote." He noted, "This is the most important legislation in Congress now. There's just no benefit in waiting. The moment is now." Moreover, some of America's most prominent historians gave an urgent warning about the state of American democracy as they gathered on Capitol Hill recently to commemorate the 6th of January insurrection. Doris Kearns Goodwin and John Meacham condemned the attack on the Capitol, which was carried out by a group of Donald Trump's supporters to disrupt the certification of Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 presidential election. They warned that the U.S. remained a crucial turning point amid threats to its democratic system. John Meacham said, "What you saw a year ago today was the worst instinct of both human nature and American politics." Adding, "And it's either a step on the way to the abyss, or it is a call to arms figuratively for citizens to engage." Echoing John Meacham's message, Doris Kearns Goodwin argued that this moment represents an opportunity for Americans to rededicate themselves to the cause of democracy, citing the example set by those who fought for the Union in the Civil War and marched for civil rights in the 1960s. The historian's comments came as many Americans, particularly those who support Donald Trump, continue to deny the dark reality of the Capitol insurrection. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina wa Mawlana Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio there's a very fascinating tradition from Imam Hassan عليه السلام that you know many of us may wonder okay, why is Imam saying this what is the reason for this I mean this is not something that you know we may do easily But if you think about it, you see that no, the Imam, obviously being the Imam, is hitting a very important point. He's, you know, targeting something that we may not have been paying attention to. And this is the importance of you know, listening to the Imams, because there are certain things we think that we know, but in fact we don't. And it's up to them, it is their responsibility to show it to us so that we will not commit that particular mistake. So this tradition from the second holy Imam, Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam, he says that when your nawafil or your recommended acts, your mustahab acts, when they affect and they impact on your compulsory acts, your wajib acts, those acts that you have to do, or as tradition says, those faridah, those things which are compulsory, then leave and ignore those recommended acts. Why? Because obviously Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants the compulsory and wajib acts from you. The recommended acts are in fact a means of attaining the perfection of those compulsory acts. They in and of themselves are not something that is, you know, without the compulsory acts, the mustahab acts doesn't really have much worth. They are there to complete the wajib acts and the compulsory ones. For example, it is compulsory for us to pray 5 times a day. One of the mustahab acts and recommended acts that can be done is the tasbih of Hazrat Zahra salamu alayha after the salah, after we finish the prayer. So if a person just focuses on the prayer beads, on the tasbih, without focusing and ignoring the prayer completely, like he has a tasbih in his hand every day and he recites it, but he ignores his salah. This is not something that a person should do. He should ignore it. And there are obviously other explanations. For example, the word that comes in the riwayat is nawafil. And nawafil is normally used for a recommended prayer, a recommended salah. So one of the things could be that if you take so much time in performing these recommended prayers that you miss the time for your compulsory prayer, ignore the recommended prayer and go towards the wajib and the compulsory one. And there are other also possible explanations that one can give about this beautiful tradition from Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make us of those who don't neglect our wajibat and our compulsory acts in order to perform those acts that are recommended and those acts that are mustahab. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.